Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. Very special edition. My main man, retired federal prosecutor, mob buster, biker boss buster, Richard Convertino is joining us. And we have the pleasure to pick Rick's brain about when he went after Outlaws Motorcycle Club icon leader, Harry Taco Bowman, one of the true, he's on the Mount Rushmore of American biker bosses and was personally responsible for growing the Outlaws into what they are today. And Rick was a part of the team that investigated him in the 1990s, that it was a combination of guys, federal prosecutors and FBI agents, DEA agents, ATF agents in Detroit, as well as down in Florida. Case was brought in Florida in 97. He went on the run for 2 years. They caught him in 99. And that was the end of the Taco Bowman reign. And Rick was critical. His participation was critical in dismantling the Outlaws. So he's coming to shed a little light. Thank you, Rick, for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's just dive in here. You were originally in Washington, and then you came to Detroit in the 1990s. You were, the tip of the spear in going after the Toko Zerilli crime family. Took the entire hierarchy of the Detroit mob down in the historic Operation Game Tax case. Talk about how you learned about what was going on in the world of 1% bikers and the fact that not only did Detroit have a very formidable Italian mob, Taco Bowman at that time was really at the height of his reign. And, Detroit was his stomping grounds, and he moved the headquarters of the Outlaws from Chicago to Detroit. And, this was, ground zero for Outlaws Nation. Can you talk about how you became aware of all that?
Well, interestingly enough, Detroit is a hub for organized crime activity nationally, even internationally. They're of course, the Italian La Cosa Nostra family, the Toco family, was here and operating out of Detroit. The Sicilian mob, very well organized, very pervasive in their ability to reach out throughout the legal and law enforcement community and develop people that worked with them, payoffs, bribes, also gambling, prostitution, the typical organized crime involvement in unions as well. But the other interesting aspect of organized crime in Detroit was the motorcycle clubs, the motorcycle gangs, which were prevailing here in Detroit, very strong foothold in Detroit. Some of the clubs. Notably, the Outlaws, Highwaymen, Scorpions, Devil's Disciples, among others, and the clubs also worked closely with the Italian organized crime family here, and in some respects were their muscle. The two things that are related that are very important to each organized crime entity, that being motorcycle gangs, clubs, and Italian La Cosa Nostra, is that the idea of omerta or snitching, cooperating is and was at least unfathomable to both organizations. So each could trust the other that there wouldn't be anyone who's flipping and giving information or testifying or being an informant against the other criminal entity, which was very important to the informality of the cooperation between the two entities that worked very well for the purposes of preserving both. The one thing that while I was coming from Washington, D.C., I was a member of the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section, which is headquartered in Washington, D.C. That section assists the organized crime strike forces in the field in the 94 U.S. attorney's offices to do RICO conspiracy and organized crime related prosecutions. either assist or take over a case, depending on the status of the case at the time the organized crime section becomes involved. So I was an attorney in Washington, D.C. that was sent out to various strike forces. Like I went to Las Vegas quite a few times, Detroit, of course, New Orleans. I had cases in Philadelphia. And so where the prevalent organized crime activity was is where attorneys from D.C. would be sent typically to assist or take over a case. And coming to Detroit, there was no real investigation or prosecution of motorcycle clubs prior to the 90s, really. And this new tool that we had called RICO, Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization Act, what I thought would be a perfect instrument to apply to, you know, various other organized crime entities like motorcycle clubs, terrorist organizations, you know, gangs, street gangs that were political corruption cases, public corruption cases. So there was where there was some disunity that could be agglutinated, if you will, into an enterprise and then prosecuted as an enterprise rather than individually. So it was a huge weapon that we had at our fingertips. And in the 90s is when we began to use that. And in particular, I did with the Outlaws, the Avengers was a case I had. And after I left the Department of Justice, I defended RICO cases, including the federal prosecution of the Devil's Disciple. So I got to see, you know, both ends of the prosecution up close and personal, if you will. But the Outlaws were extraordinarily unique in their structure, their power structure, which was top down, bottom up. It was a militaristic club organized hierarchically that was very structured, organized, and the lower levels were quite obedient to the directives from above. And that's what made it such a successful criminal enterprise.
And Taco himself, you know, I said he's an icon. He was a generational type leader. He remade the Outlaws in his image, was integral in taking them across international borders. He helped seize territory in Canada, help the club go international and out to Europe. And just to give a little bit of background on him, grew up around Port Huron, Michigan, in a town called Marysville, which is kind of like a farming community about an hour out of Detroit, maybe. And gravitated to the East Side Detroit Outlaws early in their existence. I think the Detroit Outlaws popped up in the mid to late 60s. And then by the early 70s, late 60s, Taco was, you know, ensconced in Outlaw Nation, learning from the leaders. Back then, the big Detroit Outlaw leader was a guy named Lenny Braun, who recently, he just died a couple of years ago. But, you know, he was one of Taco's mentors. And then his predecessor as international president, a guy named Stairway Harry Henderson, who I think he was originally from Dayton, Ohio, but lived in Indianapolis. But the mothership for Outlaws has always been in Chicago because that's where the club was started. Stairway Harry Henderson, for whatever reason, I think it might have been health related, steps away in 83, I think. And Taco takes over the whole show in 83. He goes from Detroit boss to international boss of Oh, I was about to say the Teamsters of the Outlaws. And he moves the headquarters for the first time in the history of that club. The headquarters goes from the south side of Chicago to the east side of Detroit. Do you recall that clubhouse that they had on, I think it was on Mount Elliott, where they still have?
Yeah, personally, I was involved in the execution of the search in the clubhouse. I wanted to go back on something you said. You know, you were talking about Mr. Bowman, and you mentioned that, you know, the president of the Teamsters or head of the Teamsters, obviously, lapsus lingue, but the interesting thing about him, the thing that made him such a fascinating character is he could have been the president of the Teamsters. He could have been the CEO of General Motors. He could have been, you know, a ranking executive in NVIDIA today. He was a smart, savvy, structured, disciplined individual. He was somebody that could be very comfortable in, you know, in a homeless shelter and talking to diplomats at a U.S. embassy. He was sophisticated and he was street savvy. I mean, this is what that, you know, through prosecuting organized crime was pervasive, a pervasive vein throughout organizations. You saw these leaders, these people who were informal leaders that had the you know, the innate skills to that would allow other men and women to follow them, to walk through walls for them. And and Harry Bowman was one of those people. He was a natural leader, and he was a very intelligent person. So he had what it takes to lead just about any organization. You could have airdropped him, you know, into Afghanistan, and he'd have run a company, the 82nd Airborne, as opposed to, you know, a motorcycle club. So that kind of mentality is what brought him to the top of that international organization, and he ran it effectively and efficiently.
He had it for almost 20 years. And to your, I want to piggyback off what you said. I mean, he was way ahead of his time, and he was the first real chameleon biker boss who could, like you said, like he could effortlessly make the move from a night out with the club in all of his colors, his hair long, the tattoo showing, and then the next day he puts on a three-piece suit, puts his hair back into a ponytail, covers up his tattoos, and is driving around in a Rolls Royce, being, you know, a bulletproof Rolls Royce, being chauffeured to meetings with mafia dons that would normally not sit down with the type of biker bosses that you see, you know, central casting biker bosses. So he really knew how to mold himself to the people that he was doing business with. And he understood something that a lot of biker clubs are beginning to understand now, which is there's a lot of money to be made for these guys if you just get off the street, if you just stop focusing all your attention on drug dealing and extortion and gambling, and you have the contacts to diversify, like a lot of these biker clubs are doing now. Marty Robert and the Hells Angels is a perfect example. Marty Robert is if not the international president, the de facto international president. He's out of Canada. And he is making major, major moves with the Hells Angels, like doing multi-million dollar, you know, gas scams and bootlegging oil and, you know, like stuff that's so beyond just the regular street crimes. And that was a path that Taco initially set off on with the Outlaws in the 80s, a good, you know, 30 years before other clubs started to do that. I mean, even his contemporary with the Hells Angels, Sonny Barger, who was the legendary leader of the Hells Angels, he was who he was, and he wasn't going to change for people. You know, he never changed the way he dressed or acted. But Taco knew that there was a benefit to sometimes changing your appearance and changing your posture and attitude. And he was just, again, he really was ahead of his time in terms of how to lead a group like that. And we're talking about, and you can speak to this, Richard, you know, a mafia family, if it's a really strong mafia family, has hundreds of people, and maybe even less in terms of buttons, mate guys. But biker clubs have thousands of people. And you know, the Outlaws have 5,000-6,000 full patch members around the globe. There's a different level of leadership when you're you know, maintenancing and leading thousands around the world, as opposed to hundreds in an individual city.
Critical part of maintaining that organization in both traditional LCN and biker clubs, for instance, is the importance in recruiting with a lowercase r, in the sense that the Italians didn't really recruit. But they were exceedingly careful about elevating.
They selected.
And it's what the motorcycle clubs also did more and more and more of. And if you look at clubs now across the board nationally, you'll see that they have the caliber of individual is a little than it was, you know, 20 years ago. The probates are longer. They fish through harder. They're recruiting a lot of professionals now. People that can, you know, accountants are motorcycle club members. When I defended the Devil's Disciples, there was a surgeon, a neurosurgeon in California who was a member of the Devil's Disciples. So these are things that were unheard of, not long ago. But the appeal of the camaraderie, of the brotherhood, of the kinship, into belonging into an organization like a club, you know, out of one come many, and the power that's evoked through membership roles that are higher is enticing to a lot of people, and that's what brought so many in. And it's not just becoming a member of a club; it's becoming a member of that club or a particular right. club, like the Hells Angels. Or the Devil's Disciples, or the Outlaws, the top echelon 1% clubs that are yep. that are more selective and harder to become a member, harder to probate through. And there's a reason why those clubs are more successful as a criminal enterprise than, you know, a club like the Iron Coffins, for instance, that are more fractious and a little looser in becoming a member.
And when it comes to the Midwest part of the country and Florida, it didn't get any bigger than the Outlaws. You know, they were to the Midwest and Florida what the Hells Angels were to California and New York, I guess. Right. And Taco, again, he didn't just lead the charge to go conquer Canada or help expand internationally. He also went down to Florida and took over that whole state, and things have changed a little bit in the last decade. And we've done some reporting on that about how Florida is no longer dominated by the Outlaws because of some political miscalculations, I would say, on the part of the Outlaws. They kind of gave an inch to pagans and Mongols, and the inch they tried to give turned into a mile, because now sure. There are dozens of pagans and Mongols chapters spread out throughout Florida. When up until the late 2010s, that was a top to bottom. The state of Florida was controlled by the Outlaws, but that was a big piece of Taco's kingdom, because Outlaws are a Midwest club. Taco's a Midwest guy, but at a very early on in the rise of the Outlaws, they looked at Florida as valuable territory that they went and seized in the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, so the reason I'm bringing this up is because the case that eventually came down in August of 1997 came from a federal court in Tampa.
Yes.
And that brings me to...
it was concurrent with our investigation in the Eastern District of Michigan.
Right. There was a lot of Michigan outlaws that were involved in that case. And the number one defendant was Taco Bowman, who was from Detroit.
And there were upper echelon meetings in the Department of Justice that decided it was best to be brought in the Middle District of Florida as opposed to the Eastern District of Michigan. So that's why that case was brought down there. But prior to that indictment, we had multiple subpoenas issued out of the Eastern District for records, witnesses, and also there was the search of the clubhouse, which, as I mentioned earlier,
can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was an amazing sight. The compound was like a it was surrounded by a multi-foot concrete wall. That was the Detroit Police Department used a armored personnel carrier with a ram to navigate through that wall. The door was a steel door that was almost impenetrable. And so it really was a lockdown, airtight fortress that was defended for an all-out war. When the law enforcement was overwhelming on that day, there were three or four outlaws who were in the house at the time.
Some guys, it's not uncommon that certain biker types don't have residences. They live in the clubhouse. Not all of them. Some of them.
Yeah, it's common. Yeah. And it's common for some of the nomadic types to just travel from clubhouse to clubhouse. Yeah. Right. Couchsurf. But inside of the clubhouse was an amazing sight. There was a huge bar. A full bar looked like, you know, something you'd see in a well-appointed restaurant. It had a pool table in the center of an enormous great room. The walls were full of tacked up of opposing clubs vests and colors. There were weapons all over the place, enough to defend, you know, Afghanistan. In one of the rooms were hundreds of videotapes of what's known as snuff films. They were selling those for profit. The outlaws had a thing here in the Detroit metropolitan area where they were serving as put in quotes, agents for women in strip clubs. And right. In return for offering protection, they were getting fees from the dancers and the prostitutes for every activity that occurred in the club. They provided security for some clubs. But the clubhouse itself was just something that it was full of merchandise that they had a store, if you will, that they'd sell outlaws related paraphernalia. They had a Gap box that was used to contribute money to brothers who were incarcerated. But the upstairs was rooms where club members stayed. Like I said, there were three or four that were present there. The one thing that I've seen throughout doing biker cases as a prosecutor is if you take the bikes themselves. Now, we probably seized maybe 15 motorcycles. And each motorcycle was a contraption that had parts from 10 different bikes, 20 different bikes. There was no one motorcycle that was in one piece. And we seized them. And I don't know what the value of these bikes were, but the one thing about biker clubs is, man, did they fight to get their property back. And they filed so many motions to get these, you know, rad ass motorcycles back. They just wore me out. I tell you, I just, you know, at the end, I just told the Mark, just give them these goddamn bikes back. I mean, the value of the bikes was inconsequential because they were a hodgepodge of, you know, 1,000 different parts from 100 different bikes. But they fight tooth and nail. I mean, that is the one thing about these motorcycle club cases that you can be assured of as a prosecutor. You are going to get pounded with quality motions. They fight every inch of every, you know, step of the case. Every bit of evidence is fought over. I mean, it's contentious when you
they're
go up against
individuals,
the motorcycle.
So it kind of fits, right? That they're scrappy outside the courtroom and they're scrappy inside the courtroom.
Very, no doubt.
Rough around the edges. I will first say that there was an issue in Detroit with Taco and some of the Italian mobsters that he was working with.
Yes,
it almost turned violent. There were murder contracts placed, I think, on both the Italians on Taco's behalf and from the Italians towards Taco. It got resolved, but you know, he was dealing, you know, Taco wasn't just dealing with other biker bosses. He was, at a certain point, he was trying to hammer out a peace with the Hells Angels, and then that went south, and then they were trying to kill each other. But in the middle of all of his biker politicking, he had to deal with an issue with the Jackalones, who the Detroit mob street bosses, Tony and Billy Jackalone, wanted to kill him because he was infringing on some gambling territory. Like, luckily, nothing went beyond the planning stages, and there was a sit down that everything got settled. But so it's a hectic time. He's leading the family. Organization. Go ahead.
It was serious enough that there were overhears and wires in the Toco investigation that picked up the plans and efforts to assassinate Harry Taco Bowman.
They had his address. They had his home address.
They had his address. They had a plan to kill him. And that information, when it was received and listened to by the FBI in the Toco case, so a separate prosecution, requires the agency then to go out and touch base with the target, mm-hmm. Which was Harry Taco Bowman, and inform him indeed that there was a credible threat against your life that we heard in a separate investigation. And so he was warned about that, gave it short shrift, and in fact, didn't take it very seriously, I don't think. It was a serious threat. And then he separately worked it out on his own through, you know, conversations with the Italian hierarchy.
A Syrian gangster named Tommy Gunn Lewis brokered the peace. Him and Frankie the Bomb Bomarito, who was the Detroit mob's liaison to the bikers, they were able to settle everything down. But this is all going on, and in the middle of that, you had Taco actively declare. I mean, there was already a war in effect with the Hells Angels. For people that have followed my reporting and content, Hells Angels and Outlaws went to war in 1974. and have not, that war has not stopped. It's a 50-year war. There have been a number of attempts to bring an end to it. Even recently, in the last couple of years, there were some peace talks, but it hasn't concluded. And it ebbs and flows. And in the late 80s, early 90s, there was some talk about it coming to an end. And Taco went and sat with George Christie, who was the Sonny Barger's number two with the Hells Angels. I think they had a couple days of peace talks in like San Diego or something. Didn't happen. And then at that point, and this was part of the case that you guys built, it went the full Monty the other direction. And it went from trying to make peace with these guys to kind of a scorched earth. We're going to go after them on their own turf. We're going to blow up their clubhouses. We're going to put contracts on Sonny Barger and George Christie. There was a situation at that point in time when the Hells Angels were trying to come into Chicago. And Chicago, as I said before, that is, you know, that is, if there's no more outlaw rich territory in the world than Chicago. That's where it all started, south side of Chicago. Eventually, pretty quickly, came to Detroit, but it all started in it was really Chicago, Detroit, and Milwaukee are the ones that really started the phenomenon of the outlaws. And you know, you had wiretaps and confidential informants. One of the anecdotes, or I'm not sure if this was on a wire or if it came from confidential informants, but there was a famous New Year's Eve speech that Taco Bowman gave in a Fort Lauderdale hotel suite. I think it was 93 going into 94 or 92 going into 93. It became known as the Rottner address, where it's not a word, he made up the word, but he basically said, I want you to be rottener, more rotten than the Hells Angels. And anytime, you know, basically a shoot on sight order. So you had a lot of storm clouds. As the investigation is going on, there are murders and attempted murders and firebombings all the way from, you know, Chicago and Milwaukee. It actually never hit Detroit because Taco was in Detroit, but from Chicago, Milwaukee, all the way down to Florida. I'm going to throw one more fact at you, and then I want to get your take on some stuff. The linchpin in Bowman's control of Florida at that time was a guy from Toledo named Wayne Hicks, who went by the nickname Joe Black. And Joe Black was put down in Florida and eventually became the regional boss of Florida, reported directly to Taco. And Joe Hicks eventually cooperates. Do you remember Joe Black?
Yes.
Do you remember, when did that cooperation begin? Was it before the case came down or after the case came down?
Before.
Do you remember learning that this guy wanted to cooperate?
When did I learn that? You know, it came to our attention midway through the investigation. I think that his, my take on it at the time was that we didn't need it. And so to you know, absorb him without, you know, buying a pig in a poke, so to speak, wasn't practical. And so it wasn't an immediate acceptance of his, you know, his offer to cooperate. That's my recollection of it. It wasn't an overwhelming immediate you know, acceptance of his offer, because there was some skepticism as to what he might be able to bring.
Or was there skepticism that he could have been a double agent?
You know, across the board, you know, it was incongruent at the time, him coming forward in the manner that he did.
Okay, so the speech was made on December 31st, 1993. So it was 93 going into 94. And then by 94, 95, Taco is dispatching hit teams to California to try to hunt, search down, and kill the leaders of the Hells Angels. So it's getting pretty serious. But then the case comes down and disrupts the attempts to kill those Hells Angel leaders. Case comes down in August. I think it was August 14th, 1997. And Taco is in the wind. He got word that a case was coming down, and him and a couple other guys take off. One of the guys was gone for like 20 years, Randy Matt Yeager, who was gone. He wasn't caught until like 2015. He was Taco's guy in Indiana, Northwest Indiana. But so case comes down, but Taco's nowhere to be found. What's going through your guys' head?
Find his ass. I mean, that was what's going through our head. He was a top 10 most wanted. Mr. Bowman was pulled over for a traffic violation in Nevada.
I was going to get to this in a second, but you jump right in. This is a good story.
Okay. So yes, it was personally a part of my professional career, because it was actually kind of startling what happened. He's pulled over. He's with his girlfriend.
One of his various girlfriends.
Yeah. He gave him his license. They had her license. It wasn't realized who he was at the time. He was released.
This was in Las Vegas, Nevada, Arizona, California. Do you remember?
I believe it was Nevada. Yeah. Okay. The border. And so we got that information a few weeks later that this had happened, and I had subpoenaed his wife into the grand jury. And she was in the grand jury, and I asked her her name. She said her name. I asked her address. She said that. I asked her if she was married to Harry Bowman. She asserted, she had it all written down. She asserted her privilege, Fifth Amendment privilege in the United States Constitution. I respectfully, refused to answer. She had it, down to a T. And I repeatedly asked her questions, knowing, that she was going to invoke her privilege. I asked her maybe 15 questions. And then I had an 8x10 blow up of the woman who was in the car with Harry Bowman.
It wasn't her, by the way, just for people to learn that was his, the paramour and the wife were different people.
Oh yeah. So I had this license, and I showed it to her. I marked it as the government's proposed exhibit, whatever it was. I showed it to her. I said, do you recognize this woman? She asserted her privilege. I said, this woman was with your husband in a car that was pulled over in Nevada. And that was the end of her unwillingness to cooperate. And she gave additional information. And that's what led to the arrest and ultimate conviction of Harry Taco Bowman. She gave information as to when he was coming to town and where he would be, et cetera.
Okay,
pissed her off.
Right. So he was on the run for almost 2 years. He was being hidden by a comp from my research, by a combination of people in the Outlaws.
Yes.
Affiliates of the Outlaws and the Italian Mafia. The same people that were trying to kill him had mended fences with him and were trying to hide him.
Right.
They finally track him down. He came back to Detroit at some point in the early summer of 99. So on June 7th, 1999, you guys trace him to a very quiet suburban neighborhood in Sterling Heights, Michigan. It's actually right down the street from where I am right now. And he was at a barbecue, like with, you know, outlaws were there, you know, I guess socializing with him out in the backyard, barbecuing some, you know, steaks and hamburgers and brats. And they raided the place and they took him.
Yeah. No resistance.
Remember that day?
Hell yeah. Yeah. Remember that day. He was compliant, was arrested, and brought into, I believe, Wayne County Jail, had a hearing the following Monday. He was sent down to, I think he waived his rights and was sent down to Florida to face the charges there.
So he was convicted in, I think, summer of 2001, right before the 9/11 attacks. I believe he's convicted. He's sentenced to life. He lasted behind bars for almost 20 years. Died in, I think, 2019. I had the privilege of getting to speak to him on the phone for about 5 minutes at the end of his life. There was no, you know, in-depth conversation, but at that point in time, I had developed a relationship with Frankie Bomarito, and Taco still kept in contact with Bomarito. And one day when he called, I was with Frank, and I asked Frank to ask him if it would be okay if I jumped on the phone for about 5 minutes. And he did. And he was, you know, Taco was cordial and, you know, asked him a couple questions that I wanted to get some clarification on some of the stuff he told me some of the stuff. He's like, I'm not going to tell you that. And then we kind of went about our lives. I was lucky enough, I guess, or skilled enough that I broke the news of his death. I got the tip off really quickly after he passed away and put it out there. And then all the other national outlets reported it. And I want to get your comment on this, because I don't think you knew this until I told you. His funeral had to be held at state fairgrounds. I mean, his funeral couldn't hold a normal cemetery or church couldn't hold the amount of people that wanted to come and pay their last respects. They held his funeral at the Ohio State Fairgrounds, where you had thousands of people from, you know, mostly biker luminaries from around the country that descended I think it was by Dayton or Columbus, where they buried him or memorialized him. And his grave right now is like a shrine. Like, he is a god in the world of the outlaws. And I'll go into a closing kind of anecdote in a moment, but people in the outlaws take pilgrimages, like you're a Muslim going to Mecca. Like, they take pilgrimages from around the country to go see Taco at his grave. What does it say to you that his funeral 20 years after he had been arrested would draw that many people, and that his legacy looms as large as it does today?
Well, a couple of things. The funerals for notable figures have had histories of long histories of higher echelon crime. you know, are subject to a lot of interest in general. But the funerals themselves are often purposefully used to conduct additional information and business, get additional information, conduct business under the guise of the gathering of the funeral itself. Historically, that's the way it's been. Traditional LCN motorcycle clubs, terrorists who at their funerals, there's cabals that occur there under the guise of going to show respect, and these meetings occur and plans occur and how to fill voids and how to conduct business in cross sections with other criminal organizations that are seemingly there for ostensibly for innocent purposes of paying respects to the deceased. So that's one aspect of it. The other is in traditional organized crime entities, in order for those groups and organizations to function efficiently, there has to be a hierarchical structure that's adhered to, pervasively adhered to. And that the one theme that you hear that is constantly present is respect. Respect is critical to the everyday organizational function. That's in motorcycle clubs. That's in traditional Italian LCN. It's in terrorist organizations. This notion of respect, false respect, maybe, but respect in general. And so the showing of this respect is a kind of a way to show your bona fides to the organization, and then to the continuing organization that you are adhering to and you're devoted to, and you're showing by coming across the country to pay respects to a man you've never met. You're really doing is paying homage to the organization. You're right. Showing that this is where I belong. I'm devoted to this organization. I will continue to be devoted to this organization. And someday, you know, when I pass on, hopefully this same respect will be accorded and afforded to me. So it's being a part of a group, a single person. That's typically what drives people to join the Marine Corps, to join the Army, to join the Hell's Angels, Devil's Disciples, Outlaws, any organization that's fraternal. That you hear that word inculcated into the members, and that is respect. And so that is a big part of a show out for a deceased member, someone like Harry Bowman, who did involve himself. That's why you see all the clubs showing some form of respect. They're showing respect for the organizational entity along and the bigger part of things.
So as we wrap up, as we wrap up, I think this is an important addendum based on my reporting on the current state of the Outlaws Motorcycle Club, and it speaks to what you're saying. I mean, everything you're saying, what I'm about to say, I think encapsulates this.
I don't mean to interrupt. I just want to tell you a short anecdote that kind of emphasizes this.
Yeah.
I had an investigation in Ypsilanti, Michigan. There was when I first came to Detroit in 1995, the first thing I heard on the radio as I was traveling into my new office. The radio NPR was on, and it said four police officers were shot yesterday in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and it had this story about four Washtenaw County sheriff's deputies who were shot trying to go and break up a riot that was involving two separate gangs in Ypsilanti. So I got to downtown Detroit, and you know, I asked my supervisor. I said, "Yeah, I just heard this report on the radio about this. Four cops were shot. You know, I came from Washington D.C." So it was the murder capital of the world at the time. It was the most violent city in the United States at the time, rife with gang activity. And I never heard of anything like that. Four cops got shot in Ypsilanti. I couldn't even pronounce Ypsilanti. I said, where the hell's Ypsilanti? He said, well, you know, where you live in Canton, Michigan? I said, yeah. He said, well, it's right on the border. I'm like, holy shit. How is that possible? So I put a task force together and we started investigating the gang activity in Ypsilanti, which was about the four most dangerous square miles of anywhere, certainly in the state of Michigan. It was like a war zone.
Yeah.
And we started investigating this case. And one of the things, and there were search warrants, and I mean, we ended up indicting 61 gang members, Crips, Bloods, and Folks, prosecuting 61, convicting 61. But one of the things that, you know, just as an example of what I meant by respect and belonging to an organization and how important it is, there was a search warrant that I was involved in, and the state police were spearheading the search, and they had a gang member there, and the lieutenant of the state police at the time was a huge guy, 6'8", 320-pound, you know, stud, grabs this gang member and he says, you know, we have a gang too, and our gang's a lot more organized and powerful than your gang. And it was kind of, and it was kind of the same concept, because the pride of belonging to that gang crime attack team by the state police, the FBI, the ATF, the marshals, the Ypsilanti police, the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Department, all of these, you know, the pride in belonging to that organization, that gang crime activity team was just as high and just as tight as the Crips, Bloods, and Folks that we were investigating. So that the respect is, you know, that occurs in any organization that has a singular purpose or a multi-level purpose, you know, can be very intense. And, you know, that's what leads people to put their lives on the line, whether it's law enforcement or gangs, for an organization or something that they believe is higher in purpose than themselves.
Absolutely. And then the last thing I'll say, and I want to get your comment on it. Right now, in 2025, the demonstrating how the respect factor for Taco extends beyond the grave. The brain trust of the outlaws right now, the base of operations right now is actually in New York, Western New York. It's the first time the outlaws have ever been, you know, that the leadership has been stationed outside the Midwest or down in Florida. So the guy that runs the Outlaws as a club right now is John Ehrman, who goes by the nickname Tommy O.
And they're in Buffalo now, right?
Out of Buffalo. And when the feds raided Tommy O's residence less than 2 years ago to take him into custody on an obstruction witness murder case that he's still in prison now, about to go to trial for, they found a room in his house that was dedicated to Taco Bowman. Like a church. Like he prayed at the church of Taco Bowman. And I believe that Tommy O, at a young age, had personal interactions with Taco. I don't think it was just, you know, he's praying to somebody he didn't know. But even if he didn't know him, I mean, this is. He might have been a former boss. He might be dead now for the last 6 years. He might have been in prison for 20 years before he died. But the leadership of the outlaws in modern times look at him as a deity and look to him as some type of compass to how to conduct business. I know another thing I know is when they went through Tommy O's phone, they found a series of photos that he had taken somewhat recently at Taco's gravesite that he had sent out in a group text to all of the other leaders of the outlaws saying, hey, I'm with God. So what does it say to you that even now, we're now almost 30 years past when he was reigning, and 2 years from now, will be 2027, and it will be 30 years since his indictment. What does it say to you that he still holds a lot of weight, even though he's been gone for that long and hasn't been in power for three decades?
Well, it's like I said, he was a natural leader, and it's someone who garnered the respect of disaffected people who felt powerless individually, who came together in a group setting to become, you know, bigger and greater and wiser and more impactful in the world than they would be as an individual. So it's that group mentality. And it's like, you know, hey, when I was a kid, in New York, the biker organization that was prevalent in my area were the Hells Angels. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a very Italian enclave, mostly Sicilians. But once in a while, you'd see a Hell's Angel, you know, or a group drive by, and it was impressive. And there were kids who looked at those bikers, you know, in their gleaming chrome and their sharp vests and their long hair whipping in the wind, and thought, you know, shit, I want to be one of them. That's what I want. I want to be a part of that. And like I said earlier, that's, you know, some kids look at Marines when they walk by and I want to be a part of that. Or you know, my group, my affiliation, my fraternal organization was the Department of Justice. I want to be a part of that. And I dedicated my life to that in the same way that a biker would dedicate his life to the outlaws and, you know, their leader, Harry Taco Bowman. So the figures get more legendary, more impressive. You know, the gleam continues, and the glints in the armor and chintz in the armor, you know, where these figures that were once, you know, thought of as impressive now become great and greater and greater, and become the ability to form, you know, the future of the organization, which is, you know, kind of what you're talking about now. So it you know, the guy was I met him. He was an impressive character, like I said at the beginning of the podcast. And, you know, I've met some organized crime figures, the traditional Italian organized crime figures, gang members, you know, people who were natural leaders, people who could have been, you know, industry leaders or academicians, you know, if they had just steered their life in a different form. And so, you know, Taco Bowman was one of those charismatic leaders who was someone who could garner loyalty, respect, consideration for his position at any given time and have people fall in line. He was the kind of guy who would say, you know, I'm an outlaw, follow me, get behind me. And people would, with their lives.
Right. I think he was a pioneer in the sense of, now more than ever, biker clubs have a status symbol connected to it that I think in some cases transcends the traditional biker archetype. And I call it the Sons of Anarchy effect. That show was very popular. And a lot of that looked at the Jax Teller character, who didn't necessarily look the part. I mean, he did a little bit. And you had all these younger people that have joined up with clubs in the last 10, 20 years. And it has less to do with wanting to ride bikes or wanting to ride Harleys together. That's where it started. Mm-hmm. But now, I know in a lot of clubs, there are guys that don't even ride. They drive. They drive their cars to the clubhouse. They just want to wear the colors. They want the patch. And I think that kind of started a little bit with Taco, where it was more of the outlaw, the Charlie patch, which is their, you know, their mascot, the skeleton they call Charlie.
Yeah.
it means more than just being a guy that rides a Harley. It's a status symbol that transcends that. And I think that's where we are today. It's interesting that people ask me all the time, it was the mobs to these kind of things are always going to exist. They're just going to evolve and change and morph. So just like the mafia is evolving and changing, the biker world is evolving and changing. And honestly, between the two, I would say that I think in 20 years, the bikers will be still thriving. I don't know where the Italian mob will be, but everybody's, you know, changing and evolving in real time. Ricky, thank you so much for joining me. This was awesome. I know that the audience is going to like it. Rick is going to be a regular contributor with us. If you're in Detroit, come check out our big event at the end of the month, July 23rd, Hoffa Mystery Solved, a live entertainment evening, 2 hours of a multimedia presentation. Rick, myself, former Detroit mobster Novi Toko, we're going to get on stage, do a panel discussion, show people a lot of stuff they've never seen before, and give some answers, finally, to the Hoffa case. So we're excited about that. Rick, you've done it all. You've seen it all. You've lived a movie script, and we're lucky that you wanted to come and be a part of the OG pod world and come and share the knowledge. So thank you so much, Rick.
Happy to be with you, Scott. Thanks.
All right, everybody, please like, share, and subscribe.
All right, pal.
Benny Behind the Glass, thank you for producing. Original Gangsters Podcast, uncovering the underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. We're out.